Sexual assault at an elite prep school, raped at age 15, followed by shaming of the victim, decades of cover-up, betrayed and silenced by her school. On Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell, Lacey Crawford is the author of the novel Early Decisions. She has been a high school English teacher, human and environmental rights campaigner, co-convener of an international conference on pandemic influenza, which sounds rather timely, Girl Friday to an English Lord, director of the Burberry Foundation, and this book is Notes on a Silencing, a memoir. Welcome, Lacey. How are you?
I'm all right. Thanks for having me.
Can we at first address what looks like a major issue? What the hell is a Girl Friday to an English Lord?
That's my way of trying to express that I was hired under the table to handle communications and other sort of bits and bobs for a proper English Lord. It was Lord Rothschild, actually, for a time when I was living in London trying to put my life together.
Wow, Rothschild. I have to tell you that my cousin married a Lord, a Baron Lord Stafford. Now the current Lord Stafford is about my age, but I've never heard that term before. Anyway, let's get to what we're here to talk about. And John Iannuzzi, our producer, and we've done several of these shows, as I told you, particularly Juanita Broderick, who, for suffering for a few minutes, maybe 20, 30 minutes, had 35 years of anxiety attacks and complete denials that it ever happened, even though the perpetrator came privately and Bill Clinton, we're talking about, and asked for forgiveness, turned out to be 3 weeks before he announced he was running in 1992. But anyway, so I've been struck by the suffering of women from these events that appear to have been largely covered up after and last minutes from impulsive, irresponsible behavior. This incident was 1990, so we're talking 30 years. Why are you breaking your silence, and why now?
Well, I broke my silence back in 1991, a few months after it happened, too, and I was silenced again. What I mean by that is that when the state police wanted to bring charges against the two boys who had assaulted me because it was forcible, they were 18, I was 15. My boarding school threatened to expel me if I testified against them. And it would have been very hard, of course, for the Concord, New Hampshire police to bring charges if they didn't have me on board to testify. And I told my parents I just wanted to go back to school and be a girl and apply to college. I didn't want my life to blow up in the way it would if we went to trial. So effectively, the school managed to sweep the whole event under the rug. I tried in a lot of ways to write about what had happened to me for most of my 20s, my 30s. But to tell you the truth, I never would have written this book had I not joined a New Hampshire state investigation into my boarding school, which was opened in 2017 by the Attorney General's office. And in doing so, I was given access to the documents that pertained to my assault back in the fall of 1990, as well as what the school had done to silence me. I was able to see in black and white what these men had planned to do. And that so enraged me that I thought it was time, finally, to speak my piece.
I have to say, going back to a different show we did with Paula Jones, the Clinton team actually leaked information about her sexual conduct. Don't even know if it was actually true or not, but to destroy her. And of course, whatever that was, false or true, had no bearing on what she was claiming happened. Tell us, first of all, the school should have been required to report to the New Hampshire authorities, but why was this in 2017 being done?
The state investigation. So there were many, many people who came forward with stories of having been assaulted on the campus of St. Paul's. This was initiated by a bunch of students, alumni from the class of 1975, who in the year 2000 returned for their 25th reunion. This is a boarding school, remember. So, you know, we all lived there when we were adolescents. They returned for their 25th reunion, and they were talking about having been molested or harassed by a certain teacher. And between them, they worked out that there were a few teachers who had been serial abusers of students, boys and girls on campus, some of them. So they brought all of these stories forward to the school, and the school did what these institutions often do, which is they hired a law firm to give the impression they were taking it seriously, but the law firm effectively did nothing and buried it. And these alumni asked for this. Yeah, they did. They did. And these reports have now been publicly issued. So this isn't a matter of opinion. This is what the law firm did. They decided that any teacher who was now dead, there was no point in investigating the claims, that any teacher who had left the country, there was no point in investigating the claims. They actually wrote they didn't think there was any value in turning over rocks, right? So the idea that we're looking into the past is not useful. And they let it go. So a couple people were frustrated and they brought lawsuits against the school. Subsequently, students who had been assaulted by other students on campus came forward, most notably a freshman named Chessy Prout, who had been sexually assaulted by a senior, Owen Labrie. He'd been admitted to Harvard. He was a big man on campus. And just before his graduation, he assaulted her on a rooftop in the spring. She was 15 and she emerged with, you know, bite marks on her nipples and a great deal of trauma. That wasn't what she had been anticipating or looking for. And she'd said no, and he didn't stop. And the trial that followed was quite a sensation in the media. So this inspired other people to come forward and say, gosh, you know, things like this happen all the time at St. Paul's. And for whatever reason, the attorney general decided that it was time to take a closer look at what was going on campus. There was a public call issued. Anyone who was aware of ways the school had been failing to protect young people in its care, because remember, everyone there's under, well, not quite everyone under 18, but most of us, you know, so the school is in loco parentis. They're supposed to be serving as parents effectively for us. Anyone who had any experience of the school failing to keep students safe and or interfering with the progress of justice was invited to come forward. I did that very, very privately and was referred to the Concord police. And that was how my second investigation began.
Tell people briefly who don't know a little bit about St. Paul's.
So this is what St. Paul's would tell you about itself. This is what I can tell you. St. Paul's is one of the most elite New England boarding schools. I say that with a heavy irony because I think elite is a complicated term, but it is traditionally a school for very, very wealthy blue-blooded New Englanders and white kids from other parts of the country, sometimes from Europe and Asia. It is enormously expensive, incredibly beautiful and well-resourced. It is a feeder for the Ivy League, Stanford, MIT, Amherst and Williams. All of these institutions that for so long have served as sort of feeders for leadership roles across American society. So politics, industry, culture, the arts, and the school continues in many ways to benefit from those networks of power. And for that reason, I think in large part, it also is very careful to protect its reputation. So if you are a girl like me, who doesn't come from a prominent family, but comes from plenty of privilege. I didn't come from a big storied family the school had to pay attention to. If she pops up age 15, having been assaulted by two 18-year-old boys, you either allow this story to break and take the sheen off your school's reputation, or you do something to make sure this pesky girl goes away. And the school chose the latter.
Tell us, to the extent that you're comfortable, what happened.
Well, I'd want to make sure your listeners are comfortable hearing what happened. I'm certainly comfortable talking about it. But I was a firstborn girl from a sort of socially traditional family in the Midwest. And I'd never really had a serious boyfriend. I was a virgin. I got a phone call late one night on the payphone in my dorm from a senior boy who was in my calculus class. I was an advanced math student, so I was in class with seniors. He was a hockey star, huge, about a foot taller than I was, had a very serious girlfriend who was beautiful. Everyone knew this couple. I'd never talked to the guy really, but he called and he said he needed my help. And long story short, I thought he was crying. He told me something about his mom and he tricked me into leaving my dorm and going to his dorm room after hours. It was about 11, 1130 at night. I went in my sneakers and my blue jeans and my parka, you know, it was late October. And he lifted me up through the window into his room. I landed on a mattress. Turned out he didn't have any clothes on and his roommate was there too. I didn't know his roommate at all. Neither of them had any clothes on. The lights were off. I said, "What's wrong?" And they shushed me and pointed to the wall and said, you know, if you make any noise, the teacher who lives right next door is going to hear you and he's going to come in. And here's what I realized in that moment. If that happened, and I knew this happened all the time when kids got caught, this teacher would come in, he would flip on the lights, and he would see me on a bed with two undressed senior boys. I was out of my dorm. This would have gone on my record. I would have been suspended. I would have been sent home. My parents would have been horrified. It would have impacted my chances of admission to the college of my choice, or at least the college I had thought I had earned with my schooling and my sports. So I was quiet, and I whispered again, "What's wrong?" And they started fondling me and pushed me down. I still didn't understand. They both had girlfriends. I had no idea what they were doing. Once I realized that they meant to help themselves to my body, I said, "Just don't have sex with me," because I thought that if they didn't do that, I wouldn't get pregnant and I wouldn't die of AIDS, which is really all I understood, you know, at age 15 in 1990 to keep myself safe. So they forced themselves in my mouth instead, in my throat, one at a time. And I was gagging. It was very hard to breathe. They held me on to the other one. And then after each of them was done, they let me go. And I climbed back out the window and walked back to my dorm.
Wow. All right. Some of this stuff I find, common attributes to assault. For instance, you said, "Just don't have sex with me." Did these guys take that as consent?
Well, I don't think they did, because I'm not sure they were worried about consent. This was a trap, right? One of them called me. The other one was there. I didn't know any of this. So this was a premeditated act. This was not like, you know, I think we sometimes try to understand, could there have been a slippery slope? Was there alcohol involved, you know, in college, for example? I was sober as a stone. I think they were too. I don't know. But, you know, they called me. They knew exactly what they were doing. But later, the school for sure used those words as well. She said, "Just don't have sex with me," and they didn't. So that constitutes consent. Now, as it turns out, it was a statutory offense, by which I mean the two of them were 18. I was 15. What they did to me was illegal anyway. Consent was
not
kind
of consensual by definition.
That's right. Consent was a moot point. So, you know, you can say all you want. Why didn't you scream? Why didn't you cry? You know, I mean, I did cry. Why didn't you bite them? You know, well, the answer is because I'm not in a horror movie, right? I'm trying to get out of this as quietly as I can so that my life is not completely upended by what these people are doing to me. That's the thing. Once you're in the position, you know you're going to lose something. You've lost the, you know, agency over yourself. You've lost the boundaries of your own body. But you're thinking, how can I stem further losses, right? I don't want this to mess up anything else.
Also, I find that at the time, women often don't realize it's rape, right?
Well, I didn't use the rape word. Honestly, I use it with ambivalence now because it wasn't traditional intercourse, right? So I want to leave open that space for women for whom that has been done. But for me, I couldn't understand. I didn't have words. I didn't know the words, you know, statutory felonious sexual assault. I had no idea what the words were. And of course, the next day, even though I told nobody, the boys had bragged. And so the next day, some of their teammates started whispering threesome, you know, threesome at me. I mean, this is another word that I didn't use, but who gets to use the words and define what happens makes a big difference to how someone is able to heal from something.
So tell us why you could not or did not tell anybody, and when you knew that all your friends were hearing all the rumors.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I think it's hard to explain to someone who hasn't had the experience. But then again, I think every one of us has had something happen that that we desperately wish didn't happen, and that we think if we don't talk about, we can somehow keep from the edges of our consciousness, right? So very simply, I was a high school girl, and these were popular athletes. They were seniors, and they had long-term girlfriends, and one of them was a friend of mine. She was on a sports team I played on. I liked her a lot. I was terrified that people would find out that I had gone to their room and done what I had done. Listen to how I held it then, what I had done, right? I didn't put the agency on them. I thought it was me, which of course is how society often does it. And I was terrified that I would lose my friends. I would lose all my friends. You know, the girls would say, what the hell were you thinking? You know, who does something like that? Certainly not me. You know, certainly wasn't something I had done. So I did not know how to say, they forced me, I didn't choose this. I did not know how to say those things. And I also intuited that if I had said those things, the school wouldn't believe me. And I was right. As later events would prove out, I was right. So it is true that rumors started to spread because the boys told everybody, you know, hey, you think she's just a, you know, dorky little freckled choir girl, but let me tell you, you know, and they would say the freckles can fly. I heard that in the hallway. You know, I heard you can leave your sneakers on anytime, because I hadn't even taken my shoes off. I mean, they just pushed me down. And anyway, when my friends, one dear friend said, Lace, did something happen with, you know, this guy? And she named the one who had called me. Right. And I just said no. Because the alternative is to say everything that has happened, which would have cracked my world right open. Do you see?
But so you consciously thought that and made that decision?
No, it's not conscious. It's reflexive.
It was reflexive.
I'm a 15-year-old girl. My parents will never understand. You know, they will say, what were you doing in their room? It will break my mother's heart. You know, my father will be set on fire if he hears about this. I mean, how, and this was 30 years ago too, right? There was no Me Too movement, you know, none of that had happened yet. So we don't talk about these things. And I was really pretty sure that it was my fault. And that there was no one who would see it differently. And on that campus, that was more or less true.
And you'd actually suffered somewhat in your home, right?
Yeah, well, So that's right. So when I was, I mean, several months prior to this, I had had the first experience. I suppose I'm lucky that I made it to 15 without anything else happening. I know plenty of kids, boys and girls, don't. But a very close friend, family friend of my father's, a very prominent man in Chicago society who had a wife and two kids, and our family spent time together all the time. They were staying in our home, in our guest room, with the kids sleeping in my room and my brother's room one summer weekend, and I couldn't sleep, and I was downstairs watching TV on the big old, you know, turn knob TV in the den. And the father came down the stairs in his boxer shorts and a tank top t-shirt and had a flask in his hand. And, you know, what ended up happening is he grabbed me and, you know, shoved his tongue down my throat before I ran past him up the stairs. He had said, you got to give me a kiss goodnight. I said, no. He made me do it. I went into my room, opened the window, climbed out, left my house and didn't come back until dawn. So the next day, my mom had sensed that something was up. I told her what had happened, and that was the end of it. My parents never did anything. They didn't confront him. They didn't tell anybody. We just decided that they wouldn't be allowed to spend time at our house anymore. I understand. I do, because I think 30 years ago, especially, if you make an accusation like that against a really prominent person in whatever community you live in, you better be ready for a lot of blowback, right? And that blowback.
Were you hurt by your parents?
I was, because the lesson is this is going to happen and we're not going to do anything. I mean, I can tell you as a parent now, I have boys, but if one of my boys came to me and said, somebody did this, I would strangle the guy with my bare hands. I would call the police, you know, and I would go, I don't care who it is. I don't care who it is. It doesn't matter how prominent this person is, but I don't want to lay this entirely at their feet, because it was a different time 30 years ago. Right. And they were not wrong that people would say, well, what the hell was the girl doing? What was the girl doing? Why was she out of bed? Right. I mean, this is what we do. And that would have changed everything in their friendships, in their community. It would have been a cause celeb. And who wants that? Right? Who wants that? I think they thought they were protecting me by keeping it quiet. The problem is, you know, the message for a girl is, this is going to be done to you, and your job is just not to say anything.
Listen to Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. Listen to our sister show, Business Talk with Jim Campbell. We'll be back on the aftermath of the event as soon as we get back. We're back with Lacey Crawford, sexual assault victim at an elite prep school. In the aftermath, you became chronically impacted by herpes, right?
I would have phrased it differently, but about 10, okay. Yeah, about 10 days after the assault, my throat started to hurt. And it hurt so much, it was hard for me to eat. And I went to the infirmary, the health center on campus, and they, you know, checked me for strep. They looked at my throat. They said, there's nothing there. You know, your throat is perfectly pink. You look fine. You know, just get a little more sleep. Gave me some, you know, Sucrets or something, you know, like some cough drops, and sent me on my way. 3 days later, my throat was so bad, I would wake up tasting blood, and I was starting to lose weight, and now I was running a high fever. So I went back to the infirmary, and they still couldn't see anything. There was nothing on my mouth, my lips, my tongue, nothing you could see with a tongue.
And you haven't told your parents yet anything,
I haven't
right?
told my parents a thing, but I'm sitting there saying, you know, and they can't see anything. And so they sent me to an ear, nose, and throat specialist in Concord, so off campus, like an actual proper doctor. And they looked down my throat with special tools. What they do is they have you gargle viscous lidocaine. So you actually numb up the gag reflex so that they can look where they need to see, so deep down the throat. And what they noticed was that in the hypopharyngeal space, which is right back sort of where your windpipe and your esophagus meet past where the gag reflex is, there were big herpes lesions on both sides of my throat. So this is, first of all, evidence of a forcible assault, because it's frankly, I don't know how it would be possible to have that happen there and nowhere else, if you know what I'm saying. And also so far back, I was a 15-year-old girl. They communicated this information to the doctor on campus at St. Paul's in the health center, but he failed somehow to tell me or my parents or my pediatrician back at home in Chicago what was wrong with me.
Or the police.
Or the police. That's right. So I did not know that the school knew what I had until I joined this state investigation in 2017 and got a hold of my medical records. And I saw their notes from the infirmary in which they had said has herpetic lesions. They gave me Zovirax, right, which is acyclovir, which is the correct drug. They gave me five other drugs too, which I now know is pretty much what you would do for a sexual assault victim, but they didn't say what it was. And then they didn't give me acyclovir ongoing. I had it for about 10 days. So I was sick for the rest of that year because, you know, I didn't have it prophylactically. I didn't have it to prevent outbreaks. So my throat was so bad that I was about 10 pounds lighter than I should have been because I simply couldn't eat solid food for much of the year because my throat was bleeding. But nobody, to this day, you can't see a sore because they're so deep.
To this day, do you have any repercussions of it still here?
No, you know, it's funny. It's kind of it's a trauma related thing. So most people who contract genital herpes within about 12 years, the body kind of tamps it down.
And 12 years. Huge, wow.
It's a huge percentage of the American population that has been exposed to this, by the way. It's, you know, it's so common and we just need to take care of each other. But for me, I had consistent outbreaks for years after the assault. Now it only happens in times of intense stress, usually stress related to the assault. So when I rejoined the investigation in 2017, I had the first outbreak in my throat I've had in, you know, 15 years or something.
And here we are. That's 30 years after
that's right.
The event happened. Now, that's the right. School, your parents get very upset initially, right, once you tell them.
Right. So I told my mom in May. So it was about another 6 months. So I'm at school. I'm sick. I'm keeping it together. But let me be clear that my grades were excellent. I turned in all right. My homework. You know, I was being such a good little girl, such a good girl, you know, getting it all done and trying so hard to keep it together. But I was, of course, shattered. I was a shattered person. And when I finally told my mom in May, she called the school immediately that night. She told them everything. She arranged to fly me home, which she did a few days later. I begged for time to finish my exams so that I could be done with the year and not have to, you know, make something up later. During that time, the school's obligation immediately was to report this. This was a, you know, a sexual assault that occurred on their campus. They are mandated reporters. It was state law. Then it's state law now. And they didn't do that. What they did instead is they conducted a little, quote, internal investigation, end quote. And their investigation, which did not include talking to me, decided that what had happened was consensual. that I was not a good girl. I was promiscuous and problematic in all sorts of ways, and that there was no need for the school to report. And that was that. It was done.
Actually, it was a good lead-in when you were saying you were trying to be a good girl, because they said you were not a, they basically called you a slut and that you were selling drugs.
That's right. That's right. No, this was an amazing thing. So I had taken Prozac, which was brand new for adolescents back then, for a little while the year before. And the school knew about it because you couldn't have prescription drugs in your room. So I had to go to the infirmary to pick up my little package of 7 Prozac tablets, little green and white tablets. And I did this secretly. I was embarrassed. I didn't tell my friends. You know, I was new at boarding school. I didn't. I stopped taking the Prozac, and I still never told anybody about it. But the school, when they threatened to expel me if I testified against the boys, what they did is they got my dad on the phone, and my dad took very careful notes from this conversation. And they said, if you put her on the stand, this is what we're going to say. We're going to say she's a drug dealer who has sold her Prozac to other students, endangering their lives. Now, that's funny.
You hadn't
now.
Even smoked pot at that time, right?
Drugs had never been my, I mean, I'm probably still alive, frankly, because for whatever reason, I just didn't have encounters with narcotics. I didn't, and I'm very lucky. But there were definitely kids who were doing a lot of drugs on that campus, and it sure as hell wasn't me, and they knew that. But what this was a first sign of, which was amazing, is that the school had helped themselves to my health records, right? This is the first proof that we had of that. I said, well, how did they know I'm even taking Prozac, you know? And my husband and I laugh about it now, like what a Prozac dealer would say would be like, hey, do you want to modestly improve your baseline mood? Like, you know, I was like, nothing. But 30 years ago that, you know, they thought that was a compelling thing to say. But if you're me, I was 16 by then. I was at home. I'm getting ready to go back for my senior year. I'm going to apply to college. What do I do if my boarding school says she's a drug dealer? What happens then?
Are you depressed, by the way, during this time? Is that, I mean, taking Prozac? Is that what?
Yeah, no, I mean, I was a wreck, but I was a type A, anxious, overachieving, firstborn girl who wasn't terribly socially settled. You know, I was young for my class. I was, you know, 15 as a junior in high school. And I was a fish out of water, you know, and I just didn't have very good coping mechanisms. And I think the Prozac was designed to help me with that. But what was remarkable about it is that the school's lawyers, you know, got my health file. And the reason they did, of course, is because they knew that I'd contracted herpes. They knew they were on the ropes. I didn't know that. My family didn't know that. But I know that now. They were in heaps of trouble.
Now, you have a school basically slandering you. You're sort of ridiculed. The school is, you know, why did you stay?
That's such a good question. Part of it is because I didn't actually know what the school was doing to me. So what they did, which is, it's sadistic, truly diabolical, not just threatening me if I testified, but this. So they knew that I had contracted herpes, but remember, I didn't know that while I was still at school. Nobody told me that. They just gave me a bunch of meds and I stayed sick all year. And I thought, I was a girl who'd been raised in the church, and I thought that I was being punished by God, frankly. That sounds ridiculous, but that's what I thought. My throat hurt. Nobody could find anything wrong with me. They didn't tell me what was wrong with me. So I just thought, I guess I deserve this, right? So I went home near the end of the school year after I told my mom, and she took me to the pediatrician the next day. And the pediatrician did a proper exam, wrote down the whole testimony. The pediatrician is the one who actually reported my assault to the state of New Hampshire, because she's also a mandated reporter. And she said to us, I'm sure I don't need to do this. I'm sure the school has already reported. Well, of course they hadn't. This was the first the police heard about it. She swabbed my throat and sent it away. And 10 days later, I found out that I had herpes. So it wasn't until the middle of June that I learned that that's what was wrong with me. The school, however, already knew. And what they did before I found out is they gathered together a bunch of boys who were on this athletic team, including the two who had assaulted me. Think about how clever this is, how dark. And their coach said, I'm not going to ask any questions, but if any of you has been intimate with Lacey Crawford, you need to go to the infirmary to get yourselves checked out for herpes.
Wow.
So what they did is they planted in the school the story that I had given it to the boys, right? Such that when we got the phone call from my doctor 10 days later, after I had seen her in June, my dad called the dean of students and said, my daughter contracted herpes from these guys. You know, we've got a real problem. And the dean of students replied, how do we know she didn't give it to the boys?
After all this has happened and all this stuff, you actually allowed yourself to really be assaulted by a couple of other guys.
I did. And I wrote this clearly because I really wanted to depict what happens to girls. I think there is, in every class, in every high school in America, there's a story of a girl who's easy, the girl who will get with anyone, the girl who whatever, right. And everyone knows she's damaged, but nobody knows how, and nobody looks after her. And I want to say, I was a good girl who had never really had a boyfriend. I really wanted a boyfriend. I had lots of, you know, dreams and designs on certain handsome people who never looked my way, right? But but after this happened to me, there was a man who came in through my door, an alumnus of the school who was in college. He drove from his college in the middle of the night and came in through we did not have locks on our doors. We were not allowed to block our doors. He came in through my door in the middle of the night, and I just lay there. I just lay there.
You felt helpless or what?
I was terrified, and I what was I going to do? Who was going to help me? Who was going to help me then? I mean, it is hard to explain, but if you say, why didn't you scream? What you're assuming is that if she does scream, people will come to her aid rather than say, why the hell is this guy in your room? What have you gotten yourself into? Do you see? So I don't think we can say to victims, girls or boys, why didn't you say anything, unless we are damn sure that if they do, they're going to get the support they need. Because the decision I made was, my life is already in flames, but as long as nobody finds out about this, I can get through this place, I can get to college, my parents will never have to know, and it will be okay.
Wow. And I thought this was interesting. You went back home, and a friend of your family, I think, who was sympathetic to your plight, said that these kinds of boundary issues become common for girls that have been sexually assaulted.
Absolutely. She said they violated your boundaries and your sense of self-esteem and self-worth. And, you know, there is a sort of psychoanalytic term, which is the repetition compulsion. There's the idea that those of us who have been really traumatized by something, particularly when it happened as children, you kind of revisit that moment over and over again in an effort, they say, to regain control over it, right? So, you know, if you lost control of your car on a certain icy curve, you drive that curve over and over once you can to make sure that you can get around that pass. And that's the, you know, by analogy, the theory is that girls or boys who have been molested will revisit certain kinds of sexual behavior because they're trying to prove it doesn't have control over them. When in fact, what you're doing is you're recreating the moment of your violation over and over and over again. And this is as common, it's textbook. This is just textbook behavior. Unfortunately, defense attorneys use it. And, you know, you pointed out the example in the first segment, right? But defense attorneys try to use this to prove that the girl was always promiscuous and therefore it's impossible that anybody forced himself on her. Well, that's, you know, there's nobody on earth who can't be forced, right? So it shouldn't matter how someone has behaved. But to me, the way I behaved after the assault, which was not exactly ridiculous, but the way I behaved after the assault is to me proof of the assault itself, because I was a completely different girl thereafter. And anyone who knew me would know that.
Wow. What is it like, the fact that your virginity was essentially stolen?
It's funny. And you know, I do spend some time writing about this in the book, because I was not a girl who had grown up sort of imagining losing my virginity and who would it be and where would we be and prom night. Those stories were never important to me. I was raised to believe that you do not have sex until you are married or almost married or basically married. That's it, full stop. There's nothing else to discuss. So it wasn't really on my radar screen. Once they had done to me what they did to me, these two, I suppose I was still technically a virgin in one sense, but the fantasy of innocence, right, that we attach to the notion of virginity, that had been stolen completely. And it made me very angry to there was actually another hockey player who started following me around and saying, you know, I'm going to pop your cherry. I'm going to, you know, he was mocking me for still being a virgin because he knew, and I knew that I wasn't, as you just said, that everything that might've been precious that I might've chosen to give to someone, right, as a gesture of intimacy and trust, that was gone forever.
Now, here we are in the era of the hashtag Me Too. And do you feel the school has really been held accountable? And even our president really hasn't seemed to be held accountable, you know, for multiple.
I can't talk about the president without sort of combusting in my chair because his hatred of women is to me so clear. No, the school has not been held accountable properly. Now, what would it look like for the school to be held accountable? That's difficult to say because, unfortunately, the only way to get these institutions to respond is to sue them. And the problem with that is that when a victim comes forward, like me, a school views her as a threat. I was a threat, you know, to the reputation of the school when I was 15, which is sort of silly because I was a choir girl, you know, but I was a threat. If you go ahead and sue, you actually become the threat that they've made you out to be. And if you get some sort of monetary settlement, then you expose yourself to people saying, aha, she's just doing this for the money. Right. She's just in this for the money, which to me is a ludicrous accusation. But even that I wanted no part of. I wanted no part of that. So there are other survivors of St. Paul's School who have sued. The school has paid out tens of millions of dollars in assault settlements. So the way this is done usually is that the school offers to settle because it will be more expensive, right, to have to go forward through the process of discovery and also potentially embarrassing, you know, to have all of these things revealed. So they end up saying, what's it going to take? You know, do you want 1 million? Will you take 2 million? And then often there's...
But you still haven't done that, right?
No, I never brought suit against the school. My parents never brought suit. Now, I could have in 2017 when I learned what I learned, when I got my hands on my medical records and these other things. Yep. I had one hell of a lawsuit on my hands if I had wanted to. And my husband and I talked seriously about what that would look like. But here's the thing. I don't want to be silenced anymore. And I don't want anyone else to be silenced. And I don't want money for my story. That's not what this is about. I want other people to feel empowered to speak up. And I want kids to be safer. So I could have taken my check, but that would not have worked for me. It works for other people, and I don't disparage that choice. Everyone finds their way through. That would not have been right for me. But also, I'm a writer, so I was in a position to be able to write a book. And if I did it right, if I pulled it off, it would get enough attention that the school would be forced to respond. And the school has been forced to respond. They have issued a formal apology to me, which I chose to make public. It is a good apology. You know, yes, color me shocked. It is a good apology. They owned what they did. It was effectively an admission of guilt. That's a big start. It is not at all the entire mountain, right? I mean, this is, there's a lot that needs to change.
All right, final segment with Lacey coming right up. We're back with Lacey Crawford, story of a sexual assault at 15 and covered up for decades. Why did the 2017 investigation by the state, why was that curtailed?
Well, that's a good question. All I know is that once detectives found in my student file documentation of how the school had silenced me, they presented that to the Attorney General's office, and the Attorney General severed them from my case. And the police called and said, we're so sorry, we can't work on your case anymore. And I didn't understand why, and they didn't understand why, and they weren't allowed to tell me certain things. I don't have a real answer to this. The best I understand is that lawyers for the school and lawyers in the Attorney General's office, New Hampshire is a small state. They've all worked together for a long, long time. Yep. Many of them are friends. Everyone's married to someone else. And they came to some sort of agreement that they thought was the best solution for everyone, but it did not include justice for me.
All right. I'm going to ask you whether you still have anger. You saw a therapist who said, tell me about it and then move on. And obviously that didn't happen. Have you moved on now? Are you angry still? Are you on a mission?
I'm not on a mission. No. I mean, if anything, the stories I've heard since my book was published, I have now heard from more than 100 alumni of my boarding school. 45 of them have told me their own stories of assault on campus. Oh. 45. Some of them, not all girls, by the way, mostly girls, mostly women. Some of them have come forward, some haven't. It's easier to be angry on behalf of other people than on my own behalf. My story has a happy ending, no thanks to the school, but I have a great husband and a beautiful marriage. I have three children. I'm really lucky, and I don't want to live in a place of resentment. There are a few people on earth I would strangle with my bare hands. Yes, I think I would. I'm not actually threatening homicide, but if I saw them, you know. But I try not to be consumed with anger, because I think the world is on fire and there's a lot of change that we need, and I'd like to be a part of that instead.
All right. I won't guess who that angers at, but let me ask you this. You don't name the two boys, but it's got to be obvious to anybody in your class who they are. Why?
Yeah, like everyone knows.
Captain of the hockey team.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah. Everyone who was there in the 3 years I was there knows who they are. People who were there before I was there know who they are. It was good gossip for many years what had gone on, right? So none of this is a secret. None of this is a secret.
So what about the impact of the book? I was disgusted by the fact that the guy was angry, said it was consensual, and basically said, "Why the hell are you doing this?" But has anything happened to these guys' reputation? Anything?
I don't know. I don't know. One of them has been in and out of jail for 25 years, not because of sexual assault charges, but because of felonious assault charges, drugs, weapons. So I think he's got his own tangles with the law, such that my bringing charges would not change anything.
And no one is, neither of them have approached you to apologize or anything?
No. They did admit to police everything I said. They confirmed all the details with the exception of that it was non-consensual. They said, you know, it was just a party. We were having a good time. But they did admit it. You know, I didn't make any of this up, and they've confirmed that. The other one, the one who called me, is, in my experience, aggressive and violent. Other people have come forward with stories of violence from him, and those have been reported to the police. It's my understanding that the school is going to take unilateral action against him, at least to protect the school. But I'm not sure that, you know, there are any crimes that will be brought against him. I don't know.
How about your classmates, especially your friends, who have they reevaluated and feel bad that they thought you might have been a slut or something and you weren't talking about it? And, you know.
Yeah, I've gotten some really beautiful letters of support, notes, texts, calls, the book's reception. I've been very, very lucky with it in a lot of ways. And that's been really gratifying. And a lot of people have been reconsidering their own experiences at St. Paul's, what a cruel place it was, what role they might or might not have played in that. All of us were complicit. It was our community. So I definitely feel some sense of vindication, for sure, that I was able to speak what was true.
Now, in terms of other fallout, I got to reading most of the book that you were close to your parents, but then I get to the end and you apparently have gone a long time, or did go a long time, without even communicating.
Yeah, my parents and I are not very close, and there are reasons that have nothing to do with St. Paul's for that.
Okay.
But it is certainly true that what happened was like a grenade going off in the middle of our family, and we're still trying to put it back together.
Where do you end up in terms of, should things change, or how do you, from a more of a societal point of view, or looking down at a prep school from up above, do you have any suggestions or culture changes, or is it better from what you've heard?
Not yet. No, it's not better from what I've heard, but there are an awful lot of people talking about it now. I mean, I think one thing that's very clear to me is that we need to get over this fantasy that there aren't going to be assaults, that it's not going to happen. It doesn't happen here. It happens everywhere, and it's going to happen because people are people. What's important is when someone comes forward, that person needs to be held and thanked and supported, and we need to get the police involved. These are crimes. It's really straightforward. You know, call the cops, tell the truth, be transparent. If an institution functions in that way, I think it's going to keep everyone a whole lot safer.
Does St. Paul's treat women, girls, equally, in the sense that you talk about them building men for leadership positions, but not really the girls there? Has that changed at all?
You'd have to ask someone who's on campus now whether it's a different place. They do have a woman head of school for the first time in the school's 160-year history. She's the one who initiated the apology to me. So many girls I've heard from, they were passed around, you know, as recently as 2016, this thing called the senior salute, where senior boys took the virginity of as many freshman girls as they could before they graduated. This is a school.
That's the Chessie story, right?
This is a school tradition. Yeah. I mean, there were kids writing about it in the, you know, student papers. I mean, this is just something that happened. So I don't think St. Paul's is the only high school where they're, you know, where boys compete with each other using what they're able to get from girls, frankly.
Has that been terminated?
One would hope so. The senior salute. I know they're not allowed to use that phrase anymore on campus. The students are banned from it. But whether male-female relationships have improved, I can tell you. I'm not there.
Have you or do you go back at all?
No, never. I think I would vomit. I don't know that I
really?
Could. I don't know that my body could go. I mean, I would if I needed to, of course. But I have no desire. No.
Do you regret you didn't leave?
No, I don't. I didn't want them to get to graduate, and I did not. I didn't want them to take one more damn thing from me than they already had.
So you had a lot of guts.
Is that guts or is that sort of stubbornness? I'm not sure. But, you know, they had already taken it from me. Why the hell should I give them my high school too, you know?
Resilience. And now, did the book exercise the final part of this and here onwards?
It's a big help. It's a big help. I would like to see the school change. I would like to help all the people who have written to me. I'm thinking of ways to do that, and people are talking to me about ways to do that. But yeah, it would be nice to be able to put some energies in other places.
And it's nice that they came clean about it after, you know, that they aren't still trying to silence and betray. Very sad story. And again, I'm just struck by how long the impact of this is on young women who obviously grow to be older women. It's really sad. Thanks to Lacey Crawford. Honor her courage. The book again is Notes on Silencing, a memoir. You have a website?
I do. LaceyCrawford.com. Yep.
All right. LaceyCrawford.com. This has been Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell. Our podcasts are available on Jim Campbell Radio. We'll see everybody on the next edition. Thank you very much, Lacey.
Thank you.